I'm Tracy Sable tonight on EWTN News Nightly. Trip to the border. As Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas travels to Arizona, lawmakers on Capitol Hill weigh in on the White House's immigration policies. Center of attention. A closer look at George Latimer's victory in the hotly contested New York primary against squad member Jamal Bowman. For all the marbles, a historic church in Italy shows its true colors. We'll explain. And a bad deal. Why Pope Francis used his weekly audience to address the dangers of drug dealers. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Feast of St. Pelagius. Our top story tonight, drama at the Supreme Court, where it appears the justices are poised to allow emergency abortions in Idaho when a pregnant woman's health is at risk, according to Bloomberg News. A copy of the opinion was briefly posted on the Supreme Court's website. A spokeswoman said in part, quote, "The court's publications unit inadvertently and briefly uploaded a document to the court's website. The court's opinion in Moyle versus United States and Idaho versus United States will be issued in due course." Well, the leak appears to show that the justices are set to reinstate a lower court order that allowed Idaho hospitals to perform emergency abortions. Idaho is one of 14 states that outlaw abortion at all stages with very few limitations. The Biden administration filed a lawsuit saying hospitals should be allowed to offer emergency abortions. And for analysis, we turn now to Dr. Barbara Perry Gerald L. Bayless, professor in presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. She is also a former judicial fellow at the U.S. Supreme Court and a researcher, former researcher, that is, for Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Dr. Perry, good to have you back on the show. As mentioned, this opinion wasn't officially released, rather posted essentially by accident. That said, take us inside the court, and how are these Supreme Court case opinions, how are they handled? You know, who was part of this process, including the posting of the final opinions?
Well, usually very carefully, as you can imagine, and I'm sure that someone today at the court has, as the expression goes, egg on the face. And I can't imagine that the Chief Justice, John Roberts, is very happy about this breach. Again, we know 2 years ago in the Dobbs abortion case, there was a leak, not on the court's website, but someone, and it's still undetermined who that was, leaked to the press what turned out to be the Dobbs opinion. So first, we should note that this was an accident. This doesn't necessarily mean this was the finished product, but it would have gone from the justices who participated in writing opinions, would have gone from their chambers to the publications unit inside the court. And that's done inside the court so that they're not sending out to Kinko's or FedEx, you know, for copies. It's all done to be as secure as possible. But anyone who has accidentally attached or uploaded a Word document that they're working on that might have been the second to the last draft knows what this is like. But obviously, there's a lot at stake here. So more care needs to be taken, I would say.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, 2 years ago when this happened with Dobbs, the Supreme Court itself said it was one of the worst breaches of trust in its history. That being said, I mean, we see this once again. How does something like this happen?
Well, we have to remember that despite the fact that this is the highest court in the land, and generally, I must say, and I've been following it, I actually made my first visit to the court as a high schooler in 1974, and I have the greatest respect for it and serve on the Board of Trustees for the Supreme Court Historical Society, which is a nonprofit, completely independent, but supports the history of the court. So I think of it as what I've called my book, The Priestly Tribe. And it rarely makes mistakes. But like all human institutions and all humans, occasionally we all make errors. And they're obvious when they're at this high of a level. But I also should say in my year there spent in working for the Chief Justice at that time, William Rehnquist, in 94-95, we had to sign non-disclosure agreements and obviously agree to keep everything that was in-house, in-house, or sort of like everything that happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And I also should say, I never saw anything going wrong. So it wasn't like I wanted to run out and report to the press that I saw some scandal. I was just so impressed by the high standard of work product there.
Yeah. What type of impact, though, do you think this has on the judicial process and, quite frankly, the integrity of the nation's highest court? I mean, how is it that Bloomberg News saw this first?
Again, it went up on the court's website accidentally, as the spokesperson for the court said. And again, those of us who work in situations, we do at the Miller Center, we do oral histories. We try to make sure, of course, that only those aspects of the oral histories that have been released by the speakers go up on our websites. But we're always double, triple, and quadruple checking. And it just looks like something slipped through here. And we should add that this is an opinion that doesn't really make a decision. It's called a dismissal of the case as improvidently granted. So it's not really even a complete decision. But as you explained at the top of the segment, it would allow to remain in standing a stay or a stop of the law in Idaho that was preventing all abortions. It would require that a federal law that requires that all hospitals that take federal funds, including Medicare, and that's about 98% of our hospitals in this country, must provide emergency care when someone's health and life is at stake. In this case of abortion, it would be the mother.
All right, Dr. Perry, thank you so much for coming on. We appreciate your analysis as always. Thank you so much. All right, staying with the Supreme Court, in an official opinion released today, the justices ruled in favor of the Biden administration in a case involving social media. The arguments pitted the White House against several Republican-led states. At issue was how far the federal government can go to combat controversial social media posts. The 6-3 vote threw out lower court rulings that favor Louisiana, Missouri, and other parties. They claimed the White House leaned on social media platforms to silence conservative points of view. And for analysis, we turn now to Charles Chip Miller, senior attorney at the Institute for Free Speech. His group wrote an amicus brief in favor of the plaintiffs in this case. Chip, good to be with you. First, your reaction to the Supreme Court ruling.
Hi, Tracy. First, at the Institute of Free Speech, we are disappointed in this ruling. This goes a long way to allowing the government to coordinate with social media companies to take down speech that disfavors.
Yeah. And for those who may not have been following this case, can you tell us a little bit more about it? And what were the big concerns or issues for the plaintiffs?
Yeah, so this started back in COVID, and as you recall, the Biden administration was particularly active at interacting with social media companies and asking them to take down posts that they disagreed with regarding the source of COVID, whether it originated in China and whether it started in a lab, and also particularly about the effectiveness of vaccines and any health effects about that. So these plaintiffs sued because either their speech had been removed for the individual plaintiffs, and for the state plaintiffs, they wanted to represent the right of their citizens to be able to engage with views that are out there, what is known as simply the right to listen. So they want to be able to hear information that's out there on these topics.
Yeah, and what does this mean for government agencies and their dealings with social media platforms?
Yeah, so what the court decided, the majority of the court, it was a 6-3 decision with three conservatives dissenting, which is different than what you often hear. But the 6-3 majority here made a procedural ruling, somewhat like in the last case that you were discussing that maybe will be released tomorrow. And the procedural ruling here was that the plaintiffs did not have standing to bring the case, meaning that the court would not hear their substantive claims. And it spent a lot of time and effort distinguishing these individuals from the claims that they sought to bring. We think that they broke new ground here in the sense that usually a plaintiff is allowed to bring a First Amendment free speech claim if they think that their speech is being chilled. Here in the decision written by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, they said that that is not the case.
Yeah, and Chip, when it comes to flagging misinformation or disinformation, how might that impact groups, say, like religious organizations or even the Catholic Church, especially when it comes to topics like abortion?
Yeah, so what this case essentially means is that you have to dot all your I's and cross all your T's and know exactly what person within the government contacted which person at the social media companies and demanded something be taken down. This is a case where, as indicated by Justice Alito and his dissent, that was joined by Justices Thomas and Gorsuch, that the court here really is, and frankly, missing the forest through the trees. You know, whenever you have actions that are taken on behalf of a government to covertly go and ask a social media company to take something down, there's not going to be good records of that. So it really, really makes it difficult to prove this out, which is why when we filed a brief in this case, what we argued is that the rule should be that the government should never be allowed to request the takedown of political speech. It's one thing for the government to get out there and say that, you know, to give counter speech, speech of its own, say we disagree with the opposing side here. But anytime the government is just out there and secretly asking for speech to be taken down, that should be found to be a First Amendment violation straight out. And it shouldn't matter what impact that that has on the decisions of the platforms.
Well, Chip, great to be with you. Thank you so much for coming on today. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Lawmakers in Delaware give final approval to a measure requiring most health insurance companies to cover abortions. The proposal includes an exemption allowing churches and other religious employers to seek waivers from the coverage requirement. The bill now heads to the desk of Democrat Governor John Carney. Analysts estimate that legislation could cost Delaware taxpayers about $500,000 annually for abortions covered by Medicaid and the state employee health insurance plan. President Biden issued a proclamation today pardoning thousands of U.S. troops who were expelled from the military because of their sexuality. In a statement, the president wrote, quote, "Today I am righting an historic wrong by using my clemency authority to pardon many former service members who were convicted simply for being themselves." The pardon applies to those who were convicted from 1951 through 2013, but does not immediately change a person's discharge status. Those who receive one will have to apply to a military board of corrections to have their records changed. This will allow veterans to apply for benefits that were previously withheld. A new poll says that most U.S. adults plan to watch or listen to some element of tomorrow night's debate between President Biden and former President Trump. The findings from the AP NORC poll say that nearly 6 in 10 U.S. adults are extremely or very likely to watch, read, or listen to commentary about the first debate. That means tens of millions of Americans will tune in some capacity for the debate in Atlanta. Well, the Biden administration announced today that border encounters with migrants are down 40%. That is 3 weeks after President Biden's order to halt the asylum processing. But Republicans say the numbers don't add up and view today's trip by DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas as an election year gimmick. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us now with the latest. Eric.
Well, good evening, Tracy. You know, this was the secretary's first visit to the border since his failed impeachment vote in the Senate. At the news conference in the Tucson, Arizona sector near the border, the secretary first scolded Congress for not passing the border agreement, which he says would have added border agents to the force. He then touted a decrease in illegal migrant numbers after President Biden's executive action and claims arrests have fallen more than 40% since Biden changed the asylum process.
The president's actions are working because of their tough response to illegal crossings and because they built on our sustained effort to exercise our full authorities to enforce the law and impose consequences for illegal entry.
I asked Democratic leaders about the secretary's visit and the latest decrease in arrest numbers.
I think the data is very clear. The volume of individuals claiming asylum at the southern border is down. Joe Biden has been leading on these issues. He strongly believes in securing our border.
Secretary Mayorkas is down at the Tucson border today, touting President Biden's 40% drop in the asylum process. Your thoughts on that, sir?
I shudder to think that anybody, Mayorkas or anybody in his, in that chain of leadership could go to the border and try to pretend like they've done something positive for the country. For them to try to tout anything as a win is detestable to me.
Border state lawmakers agree.
It's another attempt for them to, you know, lie to the American people, make the American people think that they're actually doing something about the border. They've had 3.5 years to do something about the border.
The former U.S. Border Patrol chief says the Biden administration is tone deaf about the crisis and the numbers don't lie. When you look at gotaways, more have entered the country illegally since President Biden took office. From fiscal years 2021 to 2023, there were 1.6 million gotaways, compared to a decade prior when 1.4 million got in.
We're still in record territory, even though they've noted a downturn in activity. We're still in record territory. You're still at today's pace, you still have 1 million people that are going to be encountered by CBP in a year's time.
earlier today, Secretary Mayorkas reiterated only Congress can fix a broken immigration system. But Republicans fired back and said the system worked just fine under former President Donald Trump. And by the way, the House will vote on the 2025 budget for DHS later this week. And there is an amendment to cut Secretary Mayorkas' salary to just $1. Realistically, even if the House does pass the nearly $65 billion funding bill, it's dead on arrival in the Senate in its current form because of the Republican amendments. Tracy?
Well, Eric, I know there were several important primaries yesterday for House seats, including in New York State. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, Democrat Jamal Bowman, a member of the self-proclaimed squad, was defeated by Westchester County Executive George Latimer. Now, this is the first time this was a big win by many money PACs that actually gave money to this, including the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. The political PAC pumped a record-shattering amount of money into the race to defeat Bowman. Now, the Democratic primary in the New York 16th congressional district saw a record amount of money, more than $25 million in ad spending alone. You may recall that Congressman Bowman made headlines when he accused of making anti-Semitic statements and then for pulling the fire alarm in a House office building before a vote. Bowman is the first incumbent to lose his seat in this election cycle. And because it's a strong Democratic district, the seat will likely remain in the Democrats' hands after the November election. Tracy?
All right, now to Russia, where the secret trial of an American journalist has begun. Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gerskovich is accused of espionage, a claim that he, his employer, and the U.S. State Department deny. Cameras were allowed into the courtroom for a few minutes today before the proceedings began. He could face up to 20 years in a Russian prison. During a State Department briefing, spokesperson Matt Miller says the U.S. is working on bringing both Gerskovich and another detained American back home.
We have been working to bring both Evan and Paul home since they were detained. And as we've said, we have put a significant offer on the table some months ago. We continue to work privately to try to secure their release. We shouldn't have to do that. They should both be released immediately, but we will continue our efforts. Those have been happening before Evan's trial. They will continue during the trial. And should he be convicted, which of course he will be, it's not a free trial, they will continue after the trial. But we want to see him returned home immediately.
All right, for more, let's bring in Deborah Ball. She is Deputy World Coverage Chief for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa at the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for being with us today. I know this is a really tough time for all of you there at the Wall Street Journal, so we are thinking about you. As Matt Miller just said, there is not a free trial. Russian courts rarely find anyone not guilty. So what do you think is the reasoning behind this?
We don't know, of course. We don't know exactly how this fits into the game that the Kremlin is playing and how they are maneuvering around Evan and his perspective, you know, what they want to do with him. I mean, what we do know, as you said, is this is a trial that is neither free nor fair. It's a secret trial. We have no information at all as to the proceedings. There's been no proof presented in a public way to support these allegations. His attorneys cannot speak to us. They're on a non-disclosure basis there. So it's very hard to understand what the overall picture is. We certainly don't know what's going on in the trial. Big question, I guess, is how this fits into sort of the political game that the Kremlin is playing.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit more about that, Deborah. I know a lot has been said about a prisoner swap, and maybe that's what they're using Evan for. What can you tell us about that?
I mean, the White House today, and they've been playing about it, said that they view Evan as a bargaining chip that the Kremlin is trying to play in some way. Putin and the Kremlin, but Putin has been very, very plain, very frank about the fact that he views Evan as part of a prisoner swap that he wants to achieve. He's even named sort of the person that he would like to achieve for this. I think it's quite obvious that Evan is part of hostage diplomacy, which has become more and more prevalent around the world. Certainly Russia has seen that they can play this game. They're trying to play it quite effectively. So we have to see how that unfolds.
Yeah, and I know the Wall Street Journal really has been trying a lot to try to bring Evan home. Tell us about those efforts.
We've done everything we possibly can to keep his name in the spotlight, to keep the pressure on all constituencies in Russia, including in the U.S., the administration, to make sure they're doing everything they possibly can to work for his release. We have to say that the U.S. and the Biden administration has been very, very, very robust in certainly publicly what they're talking about and the efforts they're making to secure Evan's release. We don't know exactly what they're doing behind the scenes, which is the most important part, of course, but we do feel that the U.S. and the Biden administration has been very, very strong in working towards Evan's release.
Deborah, do you know how he's doing? I mean, have you heard anything about his condition?
We do. We all write to him. He's gotten thousands of letters in the past 15 months. He's his friends, family, clearly colleagues all write to him. He's an extraordinary man who is holding up under with great grace and humor in what's a really terrible ordeal. I mean, he writes letters to us that are full of jokes. He is probing for gossip and any news among his colleagues. He sends gifts and presents to his friends for birthdays and anniversaries. We send him books. You see him smiling in the courtroom in that terrible glass cage. He's doing as well as anyone could possibly hope.
Yeah, and we're praying for him indeed. Deborah, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you.
And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including a tax in Kenya. Learn the fate of a new finance bill at the center of massive protests. Back in Israel, families of hostages are expressing impatience with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, this as he refuses to accept a full ceasefire deal.
We ask Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to meet us, the families, for a personal meeting so we can speak with him directly. So we ask him now to make an appointment with us.
The group says that it wants to ask Netanyahu to reconsider his remarks that he will only accept a partial deal which would return the hostages but not end the war. Israel estimates that about a third of the remaining 120 hostages are dead. UN-backed forces are setting up camp in Haiti as they combat the country's gang violence. The Caribbean nation has been in a state of turmoil throughout the year, as more than 2,500 people were killed in the first 3 months of the year. The Haitian prime minister says the forces from Kenya will be deployed in the next couple of days, but did not give details of their first mission. Gangs control around 80% of Haiti's capital. Well, Kenya's president says that he will not sign the tax bill that led to widespread protests. William Ruto says progress has been made in the fight to address the African nation's debt.
Our debt situation is better managed, and our budget now has space for investment and in programs aimed at easing the hardship on vulnerable people and creating opportunities.
The president also said he wants the country to work together on how to best manage the financial crisis. Yesterday, protesters stormed the parliament building and set it on fire amid the proposal to raise taxes to pay off Kenya's debt. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, traffickers of death. Pope Francis takes a strong stand against drug dealers in his last general audience before summer break. Plus, you'll be floored by what was found at a world-famous cathedral during a cleaning project. Pope Francis speaks out against drug dealers, saying that they are traffickers of death.
E anche preghiamo per questi criminali.
The Holy Father's weekly talk fell on the International Day Against Drug Abuse, and he stressed that it is a moral duty to end slavery and addiction to drugs. The Holy Father added that drug dealers are murderers, and he highlighted the work by Catholic groups to combat alcoholism and addiction to pornography. This is the last weekly audience before the summer break. Well, finally tonight, marble floors that tell a story. Amid its carpet cleaning project, Siena Cathedral in Italy has uncovered its impressive marble floors. Without the carpets, tourists can delight themselves in the stone vignettes created by great artists from the 15th century. It has been described as a mirror of the European humanism with a divinity at the center. Those are incredible. And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable, and we leave you tonight with another look at the inside of the magnificent Siena Cathedral in Italy. Have a great night. God bless.